Welcome back, everybody, to the afternoon session. We have Badab and Murray. We're really pleased to have Badab and Murray starting the session this afternoon. He's a director of the Center for Vision, Graphics, and Medical Imaging at the University of Florida. Badab has done a lot of work in the area of computer vision, segmentation, registration, a lot of stuff. He was one of the pioneers of level set-based image segmentation. And lately, he's been doing a lot of great work on diffusion MRI processing. And that's what he's going to talk about today. So please welcome that.
Thank you. It's actually a great pleasure for me to have been invited to IPAM to give this talk, and I thank the organizers. So today I'm going to talk about the mathematics of higher order symmetric positive definite tensors and their estimation. Do you hear an echo? I'm hearing myself. Okay. I wanted to say that, is Mike here?
Yeah.
So, I had too much pressure yesterday, fluids pressure on my brain in the evening, and kind of hung over from that fluids pressure. So, I think I'll blame Mike for it, because we were together. Okay.
Thank you for that citation.
Yeah. And so if I say something something that you can't understand, which probably will be most of my talk, I will be saying things which you won't. And so this work actually is my student's PhD thesis work, and my student Angelos is right here. So if you ask me tough questions, I'm just going to deflect. Okay. Right. With that, here are my. This is joint work with Angelos, who is my PhD student, and John Foden and Dina Howland from Department of Radiology and Neuroscience, respectively, at the University of Florida. Okay. So, Christos gave a. I keep thinking Christos. I don't know why. Christos. I've been associating too much with you, I guess. Christoph Langley gave a fantastic talk in the morning, and it was half my work is done. I should say more than half my work is done, so maybe I'll cut it by half, okay? So here's the problem statement. We are given a set of scalar values, which are basically the MR signal values over a sphere of directions, collected over a sphere of directions. Q1 through QK, which basically is the discretization of the sphere, in this case using a dodecahedron. The problem would be to fit a signal attenuation model, which I will write down as SQ over S0, as a function of Q, where Q is called the reciprocal space vector, which Chris talked about earlier. And S0 is the signal in the absence of any diffusion gradient. So I'm just assuming that you all understood what Chris was saying, so I'm not going to talk about what diffusion MRI is. Okay. So this is the basic mathematical problem. Given this, you want to fit a model which characterizes this MR signal attenuation. Okay. So the diffusion tensor model, which has been prevalent since 1994 when it was introduced by Peter Basser and his colleagues. I'll very briefly say something. Diffusion propagator, which is an oriented Gaussian in this case, written like so, is basically the Fourier, you can get the signal attenuation model from the propagator by taking its Fourier transform, and then you basically end up with another Gaussian in this case. The quadratic form in the Gaussian is your is the model that is used to express is the tensorial model that is used to express the diffusivity function, okay, at each image lattice point. Okay, so one can estimate, given the signal S, how do you estimate the D? And Chris talked about earlier the linear estimation technique, which is basically taking log on both sides and doing a linear least squares estimate. I believe the right way to, I would go to the extent of saying the right way to do it is actually use nonlinear regression with whatever regularization constraints that you want to put on it. Okay, the reason for that is because if you took log on both sides of this, of the signal measurements, the data, and the mathematical model that defines the signal attenuation, if you took log on both sides and did a linear least squares, basically what you're assuming is that you are the noise is being added to the log of the model, okay, which is really not true, okay. Log of the signal, okay. So anyway, but it turns out that for small noise, it's okay to do that, okay. So you can do the linear regression and do regularization, whatever, for a small amount of noise. But if you go for high B values, you can't be doing that, because high B values, you will see large amounts of noise. So the better thing to do is actually use the nonlinear regression, and even go to the extent of the complex signal and using Gaussian noise on the complex signal, okay, rather than taking the magnitude. Okay, so that was something which we did that in our group, and then there were many others who did who followed what we had done back in 2003. Okay, so what are the limitations of this diffusion tensor model? So if you have local axonal architecture, which is pretty complex, for instance, within a voxel, if you have intra-voxel heterogeneity, like kissing fibers, crossing fibers, or splaying fibers, you can't be using a simplistic rank 2 tensor model, okay? Because the rank 2 would just average it out, as opposed to higher rank tensors that would pick up the geometry, okay? But there are many other ways of achieving this too. Okay, so I'll just give you some kind of a taxonomy, which is like model-based methods. Okay, you have your diffusivity function dg, where g is the gradient direction. This was back in 1965, then the tensor model came about. Then the spherical harmonics representation of the diffusivity function was introduced, I believe, in Larry Frank's work in MRM-02. Evan Ozerslan, he showed the generalized diffusion tensor model, basically higher rank tensors, and actually generalized the Bloch-Torrey equation as well. Okay. So that's some history there. Okay, in MRM 2002, in Took's thesis, David Took's thesis, he proposed the discrete mixture model, the multi-compartmental model. So the idea there is to be able to model intra-voxel heterogeneity. Okay, since a single tensor, a rank 2 tensor, cannot handle fiber crossings and splaying and things like that. Okay, so of course the issue then would be how many components in the mixture are you going to take into consideration. Okay. Alright, so and then my own work with a graduate student of mine back then, Tim McGraw, we talked about using discrete mixture of von Mises distributions, because you are talking about taking data on a sphere, so the kind of distribution that you ought to be using is, for instance, von Mises distribution, which is, you can think of it as a Gaussian on a sphere, okay? But then, since it's only a single bump, it's only a single mode distribution, you need something more complex so you can have a discrete mixture. But once again, the problem is how many components are you going to specify there, okay? So more recently, I've done some work with a student of mine who is no longer a student now. He's at Siemens, where we said, forget about this discrete mixture and go to the continuous domain and say, let's do this as a continuous mixture model, okay? But this mixing density then is specified on the space of positive definite matrices, okay? So you have to solve a hard inverse problem, which is given the signal, finding a mixing density, okay? One way to solve it is to find a parametric parameterization for that mixing density, for which the integral can be solved, let's say, very efficiently. So one such parameterization is to use Wishart distribution, which is a distribution on the space of covariance matrices, okay, which is quite widely used in multivariate statistics. Okay, so we came up with actually a closed form solution for that, and it kind of generalized the Stiesky-Tanner signal attenuation model, because in the limit of the closed form expression that we got out of this, the limiting case was Stiesky-Tanner equation. So there were two things that we got out of that model, which was one, a new way of looking at what the signal attenuation ought to be. The other thing was we could handle multiple fibers going through a single voxel. Okay, so the intra-voxel heterogeneity as well as dealing with a much more complicated signal attenuation model that truly handles how the signal attenuates for large B values, okay? So that was a neuroimage paper. And more recently we said, hey, if I can do continuous mixture of something, I can do a continuous mixture of von Mises as well, okay? Well, anyway, I'm not going to talk about this today. So coming back to this side, the generalized DTI, so what I've been talking about are model-based methods. On the other hand, you can have model-free methods, which is the QBI that Chris talked about in the morning in detail. You have the DSI, which is Van Vedien's work in MRM 2005. I have something highlighted here in red, which basically is saying that in QBI, you have spectral broadening of the peaks because there is a modulation of the ODF with a Bessel function of order zero. But of course, if you want to get sharper peaks, you can use the sharpening technique that Chris talked about earlier. Okay. Boy, I really must be liking Chris. I'm saying Chris so many times. DSI, the limitation is time complexity because you have to densely sample the Q space. Okay. And it takes a lot of time to do that in order to generate high resolution images which won't have the problem of intra-voxel heterogeneity. Okay, the other model-free method is diffusion orientation transform. This is actually joint work of Evelyn Ozer-Sloan in his thesis with me and his thesis advisor, okay, where basically express the Fourier relationship between the signal and the water molecule displacement probability PR in spherical coordinates and evaluate the radial part analytically. Okay. Once again, in this case also there is a modulation with a function which is actually not analytically expressible. Okay. In order to get rid of that modulation or spreading of the peaks of PR or smearing of the peaks of PR, you can use a bi-exponential signal decay, but that would require sampling on two concentric spheres, and that takes longer time to acquire the data. Okay, so these are some shortcomings of the model free methods. So I'll stick with the model-based methods and look at the Cartesian tensor formulation and see what can be said. So one of the issues is how do you enforce positive definiteness for high rank tensors. So that's what the rest of the talk is going to be. Okay. Now, why higher order tensors? You've seen that I already mentioned that you can't deal with crossing fibers and other complicated local geometries. Okay. So here is a rank 4 tensor representation for a crossing fiber. Here's a real data set of an excised rat hippocampus. What we are trying to show is that if you don't do the enforcing of positivity constraint on the rank 4 tensor, you'll end up with a large number of tensors with negative values, okay? And non-positive tensors in the dorsal region in this case, but I mean they were non-negative. There were negative tensors elsewhere as well, a negative diffusivity, which doesn't make sense. Okay. Okay. So, and it can lead to wrong predictions, wrong estimation of orientation as well, that you will see in the experiments that I'm going to present later on. Okay. All right. So. Here's some previous work using high-rank tensors. The generalized higher-order Cartesian tensors, I mentioned Ozerslan, Marisi, Liu, and others. I believe this is from Stanford in MRM-04. Then there is the spherical harmonic expansion of Frank, Alexander, Chen et al. This is from University of Florida. But none of these techniques preserve the positive definite property. They don't enforce it. Okay. All right, so let's look at what's going on from second rank to fourth order symmetric tensors. So what's flashing out there is the diffusivity function, and then we'll take the diffusivity function, put it in a quadratic form, okay, with G as the gradient direction vector G1, G2, G3 in three dimensions. Okay. So we'll write that in the quadratic form. There's the quadratic form. And I'll rewrite that in terms of coefficients of the tensor dijk with I plus j plus k equals 2. Okay. In the rank 4 case, or order 4 case, for the symmetric tensor will have 15 coefficients or 15 unknowns that you have to estimate. Okay, the notation is I plus J plus K is 4. Okay, so you have the fourth order polynomial in this case that you can stick it into vector notation. We transpose GV, which is where G is called the Gram matrix, which is of size 6. Okay. I want to emphasize that V is a function of G. Okay. So V is a function of G, although it's of size 6. Okay. So this you need to make a note of that. All right. So the fourth order tensors can be thought of as basically in three dimensions can be thought of as equivalent to ternary quartics. Okay, which are basically a homogeneous polynomial of degree 4 in three variables that can be written like so. Okay, so basically there is an equivalence between what I showed you earlier in the fourth order tensor and the ternary quartics. The reason I'm talking about ternary quartics is I'm going to appeal to a theorem by Hilbert which we'll use on expressing the positivity of rank 4 tensors. Okay. So since diffusivity is a positive quantity, we want to enforce this. Okay. But at this juncture, I want to point out there's earlier work by Maher Moher that appeared in very recently in Journal of Mechanics and Applied Math in 2008, and also by Ghosh and others from India, Rashid Darish's group. The paper was in ISMRM 2008, where the theory was worked out in Maher Moher's work, who is an applied mechanics person. The assumption was that SPD, or symmetric positive definite fourth order tensors, is basically obtained by a tensor product of SPD rank 2 tensors, okay, which really is not going to span the full space of rank 4 tensors. Okay, so the positive definiteness in that case was, in their case, was defined as the diffusivity function dg, which is v transpose gv, is greater than 0 for all non-zero g. Remember, I said v is actually a function of g, okay? So in this case, g belongs to R3. Okay, they said if this is greater than 0, then it implies that g is positive definite, okay? That's not really the case. This is not true for all positive ternary quartics. I'll show you an example. Here's an example. A simple ternary quartic is the fourth order in three variables, g1 to the 4, g2 to the 4, and g3 to the 4. For this to be greater than 0, the Gram matrix will have zeros on the diagonal, okay? Which means, truly speaking, what you need is, if you were to use the definition that I showed earlier by Moher, his positive definite positive definite rank 4 tensor will map onto the boundary in this case, okay, which will be a semi-definite case. Okay, here's another example where you have zeros on the diagonal, and it's still actually a fully valid positive definite ternary quartic. Okay. Okay, so as I pointed out earlier, Angelos did this work, and we presented a paper in IPMI 2007, where we were the first to impose the positive semi-definite property on fourth order tensors. And by appealing to the Hilbert's theorem, it says that any ternary quartic can be written as sums of three squares of quadratic forms. Okay, that's what this is saying. So you can take the diffusivity function and express it as sums of quadratic forms, squares of quadratic forms. And I will write that the coefficients, I expand it out into the 6 vector, collect it into a matrix, and then write out the rank 4 case in this form, okay, where CC transpose is the Gram matrix G, okay, but G is at most rank 3, even it's a 6 by 6 but rank 3 matrix. Okay. Alright, so there is a non-uniqueness issue here. You can stick a rotation matrix in there and you'll get CR and R transpose C. You can get different versions of C and you won't be able to make a distinction. Okay. That differ by rotation. So one way to handle that is use QR decomposition of the C matrix and pull that together and get rid of the rotation. Okay. So now if you look, you basically have 15 coefficients that you need to specify for the rank 4 symmetric, fully symmetric tensor. Okay, there's one more non-uniqueness issue which comes about because of you can write C transpose, it's minus C, C minus C transpose, okay? So how do we tackle this? So one possible way to solve this is using something called Iwasawa decomposition. So Iwasawa decomposition is like, or factorization is like, you can think of it as ODU factorization, orthogonal matrix, diagonal matrix, and upper triangular matrix with unit upper triangular matrix. Okay, and it gives you a unique factorization for PN, which is a space of positive definite matrices. Okay, actually, it's a much more general decomposition. It can be used for something called semi-simple groups. Okay, but I won't go there. So here, this is the Iwasawa decomposition where G is your positive definite matrix, WB are blocks, W is PK, and V is PM. So P denotes the space of positive definite matrices. Okay, and X is just a real matrix. IK and IM are identity matrices of size K and M. Okay, and the notation with the smooth braces and the square brackets is basically like a group operation. Okay. All right. With that, you can actually take the Iwasawa and also do that for semi-definite matrices. Of course, in this case, it's not going to be unique unless you choose the rank of W to be equal to K, in which case you get a unique unique factorization for even semi-definite matrices. Okay. All right. So you put that together using this. Using this form, and you have your G. What we can then do is we can take the set. We can set W in terms of C1, C2, C3, the coefficients that I showed you earlier, C11, C22, and so on. And then, which basically can be thought of as the Cholesky factors for W. Okay. All right. So I can rewrite the Iwasawa blocks in terms of C's, okay? And now, in this case, what will happen is that the diagonal terms in the upper 3x3 block, which turn out to be the Cholesky factors here, okay? The diagonal terms, they have to be semi-definite, okay? And that semi-definiteness comes in from this rank constraint. Okay. All right. So far, so good. So basically, we got rid of the minus C ambiguity by doing that. Now, I want to go one more step and say that I can go back, and what we really want is positive definiteness, not just positive semi-definite. Okay. So here's a theorem which basically says that I can, it's equivalent to what the essence of this is, equivalent to saying testing for positive semi-definiteness is the same as testing for positive definiteness, okay? Because I can take the boundary point, which is the semi-definite case, and perturb it slightly and generate the positive definite case, okay? And in the limit C tending to zero, in practice, I can set that to the machine zero and make it arbitrarily small. There it is. Okay. So now I'm basically done with all the formalism, and now, given that kind of parameterization, how am I going to do the estimation? So this is pretty standard. You do your nonlinear least squares here, and you can put a regularization constraint. In this case, actually, the notation here is SI is the signal, S0 is the zero gradient signal, and there's your parameterization for rank 4 tensor, and the gradient with respect to the coefficients, in this case, with respect to the C's, can be computed analytically for this cost function, okay? And then you can easily, once you compute those, you can easily write them down in terms of the DIJs that you need. Okay. All right. Did I miss something? No. Okay. So now the regularization comes in. So how are we going to do the regularization? We use the L2 norm as the distance between two tensors. Okay. In this case, of course, the integration has to be done on S2 because this is with respect to the direction G. Okay, so you want to sum this over all the neighbors. You're asking the neighboring tensors to be somewhat like U. Okay, so that's the smoothing constraint. Okay, and this integral can be computed analytically. All right. So it's not the Riemannian metric on the space of rank 4 tensors, because it's very hard to characterize the geometry of the rank 4 tensors, and it hasn't been done in literature. Okay, so I can't use, it's not like rank 2 tensors where I can go back and look up advanced differential geometry book and pull the stuff out and say that, hey, everything is done, I can just borrow that technology. Okay, this is an open problem. Rank 4 tensor, characterizing the geometry of rank 4 tensors is an open problem. Okay. All right, so I have the diffusivity. I can do a lot of things with diffusivity that you have seen earlier in the talks, people computing FA and mean diffusivity and all sorts of things. Okay, that's the reason why you would be interested in diffusivity. But if you want to actually get do fiber tracking, you need to go after the water molecule probability displacement function, which is the Fourier transform of that of the signal. Okay, and there are different ways of getting the probability distribution at each lattice point, given the mathematical description of the signal attenuation model. Okay, in the case of high rank tensors, you plug in the high rank tensor in. Instead of the SQ over S0, and then do the Fourier transform for it. Okay, so one way to solve that is solve it numerically, or you can do the diffusion orientation transform that takes this Fourier transform relationship, expresses it into spherical coordinates, and solves the solves it analytically. So solves the radial the radial part analytically. Okay. The other possibility is that you can ask the question, just do the Fourier inverse, okay, and assume that PR can be written as a rank 4 tensor. Okay, so this was something that I did with Angelos in ISB 2008. All right, so that's it for the theoretical framework. So it looks like I'm going really fast. I should slow down. Mind you, I have a severe dehydration, so I need to drink lots of water. Okay. So these are the experimental results we have. The first set of experiment was done on synthetic data, where we generated multiple fibers, which are crossing fibers, and added different amounts of noise. Did the reconstruction using rank 4 tensors and see how much, what the angle is between the true fiber orientation and the estimated fiber orientation. So the details are, it's a realistic simulation using Sodermann's work in MRM 95, which is a pretty realistic simulation of an MR signal, a diffusion signal. And we used 81 directions, B value is 1250 with different amounts of added noise. Okay, and this is recent noise. Okay, so this is the result of varying signal to noise ratio, error in angle, error in degrees, with and without positive definiteness constraint. You can see that the positive definiteness constraint does decrease the error. Okay, of the estimated orientations. All right, this is computing a scalar quantity from the rank 4 tensor approximation. The scalar quantity in this case is called generalized trace, okay, which is basically integral over integral of the fourth order function, fourth order tensor over this field. Okay, that's the definition of the generalized trace. So you can see again that with and without positivity constraints, you see a huge difference in terms of the standard deviation of the trace, okay, over the whole image. Okay, this is also for synthetic data. We have a comparison with ODF and DOT. DT4 is the rank 4 tensor. Of course, DT4 is better than the other techniques. Okay, okay, so these are real data experiments. X size hippocampus, 21 directions, B value 1250. Okay, so let's see. What you are seeing here is the S0 image. Let's see if this works. So this is a small animation using first rank 2 tensor approximation, and then you'll see it'll grow into a rank 4. Okay. Well, everybody was showing pretty pictures, so I might as well show some, right? So those are the fiber tracks from this Hardy data using rank 4 tensor approximation. This is a rat hippocampus, segmented actually. Okay, I guess that's enough. Angelus, did you put this in an infinite loop or something? No?
Can I watch it again?
You're tempting me. Okay, so this is another example, junction of the corpus callosum and the cingulum. You can see the fiber crossings, and rank 4 tensor will pick up the fiber crossings. Well, there's no validation in this case. It's very hard to validate. I think somebody was somebody commented on that. Who was that? Was it CF? You did, yeah. I mean, there are ways to validate this actually, but it's not an easy thing to do. One way to validate would be to take the histology slices and stack them up, register the histology, and try to. But the histology will, of course, have very high resolution, okay? And the resolution of the diffusion MRI is much smaller, of the order of 40 microns. And I think the histology could be as small as maybe 10 or even 5 microns, okay, the resolution. So there's a huge resolution issue there. If you want to try and map out the fibers in the histology and then do it on the MR, you want to make sure that this the plane of the cut in the histology is the same as your MR imaging plane. Okay. Otherwise, you will have problems trying to match things. Of course, you don't have fibers which are planar, so you have to do the tracking in 3D after stacking of the histology. Okay. So anyway, I won't go in there. So we haven't done that yet. So this is the zoom in version of that location, which is the cingulum and the corpus callosum intersection. Okay. All right. Here's another example. This is spinal cord data. We are working on looking at spinal cords, injured versus controls, and trying to see, classify the injury. In this case, the injuries are contusion injury. Okay, So we would like to try and see how much recovery of, motor recovery is there, if we can observe the, in this case, the small animals, which is rats. By observing them over time, we want to try and correlate motor recovery to structural changes. Okay. All right. So this is the same data set. GA is generalized anisotropy, which is related to the variance of the diffusivity function in the voxel. Okay. S0 is the zero gradient image, and these are the images that correspond to the coefficients, the C coefficients that I mentioned earlier, okay, and from which you can compute the tensor coefficients, and the notation, as I said, is I plus J plus K, which is the three variables X, Y, and Z. Okay, so if you have, let's look at, in the spinal cord, basically the fibers are going all the way down through the spinal cord. So the Z direction, which in this case would be the third one, 004. So if you look at this, you can see that the generalized anisotropy is pretty bright in this case. Okay. The diffusivity coefficient, 004, is very bright, and that basically is telling you that along the in the Z direction, you have very high diffusivity, which is what you should expect. Okay. The red here are basically some negative values in the diffusivity coefficient. Is that true? Is the red
negative value very much?
Okay. Okay. So some more experiments. Estimated tensor field with and without positivity constraint. Once again, you would expect here the RGB correspond to XYZ, and you should be expecting very coherent set of single fiber directions, no crossings. This is the white matter, this is the gray matter. In the white matter, you should be expecting no crossings in this direction. Whereas without the positivity, you do see some crossings, and with the positivity constraint, you get the coherence. All right. So here is the control rat and three injured rats. And I'm looking at the region between the two dorsal horns. You can see that in the control case, you have, which is, by the way, this is white matter, so you should expect a pretty coherent set of tensor directions, the maxima of the probability distribution in this case, which would be the fiber directions, okay? Whereas in the injured case, you see this whole region is messed up, okay? So let's look at some very simple analysis that we did. The angle between intravoxel fiber orientations in the control case and the injured case in this region of interest, which is shown in pink. You can see that the orientation should have been almost 90 in this case multiple fiber orientations. Actually, in the case of single fiber, what you would see is a dominant peak and a very tiny peak that could have been caused due to noise. Okay, so that should be pretty much straight out down all the way down along the spinal cord. Okay, and in the injured case, you can see that degree has reduced considerably. Okay. Here you are seeing histogram of the intravoxel variance, and I pointed out earlier you can compute this variance, which is related to the generalized anisotropy, by the way. In the control case, if you look at the histogram and compare it with the injured, you will see that we have superimposed the injured on the control case. So there is a shift in the peaks, which basically tells you that there's a reduction in the variance. Okay, and if there's a reduction in the variance, which means there's a reduction in the generalized anisotropy or diffusivity in this case, which is to be expected. Okay, so going a little further, we took the 15 tensor coefficients that I pointed out to you earlier for the rank 4 case, and then constructed a covariance matrix out of these 15 tensor coefficients, summed them over the region of interest, and because these are covariance matrices, they are positive definite, so you can actually use the Riemannian metric that Chris talked about earlier. Okay, and use that to do clustering. You can see that the injured, all the three injured cluster together in comparison to the control. This is using a simple unsupervised clustering technique. In this case, it was an agglomerative clustering technique, but you can use any other standard clustering technique. Okay. So, I believe with that I want to conclude. I'm really early. Okay. So, what I presented is the first existing parametrization technique for full space of, that covers the full space of positive fourth order tensors. We have a lot of closed form computations, closed form expressions for doing the computations, so it's very efficient. We have a reliable way of estimating the generalized quantities like trace and variance. Why is it reliable? Because we have a way to impose the positivity constraint. Okay. And it's more accurate to detect the crossings using this positivity constraint as opposed to without it. Okay. Okay, I also showed you a small set of comparisons between injured and control rats for spinal cords. Okay. All right, with that I think I'm done.
Thanks a lot, Bala, for this almost exhaustive depiction of the local diffusion model and for the great work. Is there any question for Bala? We have a few minutes for questions.
Yes.
Yes, Paul.
Paul.
Yeah, I have a question about how you would do population statistics on these. So we've seen several representations of the PCI data. So you have the fusion tensors and then the natural AFC. Or you can use OES.
Paul, you're fading out. I can't hear you properly. Yeah.
I'm just saying that when you introduce a metric that allows you to do population statistics on objects, I mentioned earlier that if you have a population that is represented using these four-fold tensors, the way in which you would do comparisons across subjects or you build statistics is like any mean, right? You take the 16 coefficients and you make the variance matrix and then you derive Riemannian metric from that. What did you say?
Okay, so that there was nothing new about it, because in this case the 15 coefficients are the rank 4 tensor coefficients. I'm not using the geometry of rank 4 tensors because we don't know what it is. Okay, so instead taking the 15 coefficients and representing deriving from the 15 coefficients covariance matrix at each a local covariance matrix gives you basically rank 2 positive definite matrices. You know this. You know the space completely. You can use the Riemannian metric there to do whatever statistics you want. Okay, but I'm not claiming that I'm doing statistics on the space of rank 4 tensors, which I don't know. Okay, I don't know the geometry yet, but just. Compared to rank 2, absolutely, there's no question. otherwise we won't be going to line 4. I mean, that's obvious, right? Because you can deal with much more complex local geometries, tissue geometry, whereas you can't in the other case. And obviously, if you can take the 15 coefficients, and if you knew the geometry of the space of line 4 tensors, then there's more power. But still, you can do something reasonably well and very practical, because you can deal with the 15-dimensional vector and do whatever you want with that vector and do statistics on that. Okay. I think at this point, that's probably the best thing to do until our next paper, which will be on the space of, on the geometry of line 4 tensors. Yes.
Following on that, so you have 15 coefficients that I guess you estimate on each voxel based on about the theory of the observation.
Yeah.
Have you tested how reliable this is? I mean, doing just for one of the few voxels cross validations on the observation, seeing how you can rely on the coefficients, which one are robust, which are.
So the first set of experiments, which were synthetic data experiments, basically answer your question, because we were doing estimating the orientations within the voxel under different noise conditions. And in the synthetic data case, I already know what the orientation ought to be because I generated the data, right?
Yeah, but
so
you're not testing the 15 coefficients. The suggestion was to use this high dimensional vector.
No, but the 15 coefficients play a role in computing the probability.
Yeah, but you compute a function, a scalar of a small dimensional function of this high dimensional vector. Maybe that this function is robust, whereas the baby sample vector that is essentially the same one. No?
So there were two things I presented. One was actually computing the orientation. So how do I get the orientations? I compute the from the diffusivity, I go to the probability, okay? And then once I have the probability, I can find the maxima of the local probability functions, okay? The maxima give me the orientations, okay? But that local probability function is represented by a rank 4 tensor with those 15 coefficients.
We can assume that.
Okay.
But what I mean is, you maybe have an over-parametrization, something like that. You may get the correct probability, but then maybe some uncertainty of the
maybe, yeah. But there's always an error. Yeah.
I want to ask, when you're computing the probability, you're computing it from directly the signal or the diffusivity function that you've computed using your parameters?
So I showed you four possible ways of computing the probability. One is solving the Fourier transform integral, okay, with the signal. The signal attenuation model being the rank 4 tensor model, right? Because in the Fourier transform, what you have is sq over s0, e power whatever, okay? And you just substitute for that sq over s0, the rank 4 tensor model, okay? The signal attenuation model, which would be e power minus, in this case, g transpose, or q transpose gq, okay? In which last method?
The one where you have the closed form of the where you're writing the probability distribution as a tensor function. The one that you presented it
at ISB.
ISB, sorry.
I don't remember. What did you do, Angelus?
You can either use directly the acquired signal, or if you have already denoised or modeled the signal with another model like the forward tensor here, you can use the new denoise the same value, the approximated value.
So for the results here, which one did you use?
We have used the Fourier transform representation in all of the results.
I have one quick question.
Yeah.
We already discussed a little bit of this together, but I was surprised that you could actually see these ODFs as sharp as if you get. You know, when you do cubal imaging, you have to do sharpening to actually get those nice fiber ODFs. Which is pretty much what you get directly out of your methods, right?
It's not ODF. it's the PI, which is different from the ODI.
Right. Okay. So that's the reason why you don't have this kind of smoothing because of the directly comes from the okay.
Yeah.
All right. Okay. Thanks. Any other question?
What is the PR? You say the PR.
Yeah.
The PR.
It's the displacement probability function. P of R.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. PR, the PR person.
You're getting an rotationally invariant representation by your decomposition of the first order tensor. Are you able also to quant to arrange those positions in some way to get some scalar representation of the shape?
By the way, the rotation invariance is the L2 norm that was used for comparing two tensors.
Yes, but I mean, when you do the Cholesky decomposition and then you get your coefficients, I mean, those coefficients are containing all the shape. I mean, it's easy in the presentation to separate the shape from the orientation of your figures.
Yeah.
So have you tried to use this shape representation with coefficients to get indexes of the shape, like this has four lobes or one lobe?
Not yet, but that's cooking. Sure. I mean, remember I said structural changes.
Yeah.
Yeah, sure.
All right, we should stop here. Thanks, Bubba, again.